Hi, and thank you for joining us for In All Things, a weekly podcast of the Evangelical Presbyterian Church. I'm Rachel Joseph. Your host for In All Things is Dean Weaver, State Clerk of the EPC. We pray that God uses Dean and his guests to inform and inspire you about the EPC and how God is working in and through our global movement of Evangelical Presbyterian Churches. The motto of our family of congregations is, in essentials, unity, in non-essentials, liberty, in all things, charity. Now, here's Dean.
And thank you again, Rachel, as always. And thank you, my friends, for joining us again for another edition of In All Things, a special three-part podcast. I think in the 2+ years we've been doing, this is our first 3-part podcast. But we've had so much to talk about that has been so exciting with Holly Lazaro, who is a ruling elder in the EPC, about to become the moderator also. She's moderator-elect of the Presbytery of the East. She's going back to school and doing some deep dive theological education. She's written a number of books. We're going to talk about those today. And she is the founder of Study with Friends. And we have yet to give the information on how people can find Study with Friends. So remind me, we have to do that today. But Holly, welcome back for part 3.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to land this plane today, one way or another. The conversation has just been so rich because we've been talking about digital ministry and the strengths of that, the weaknesses of that, the importance of in-person ministry and how digital can be the front door and not the back door, the two pathways of evangelism and discipleship and the ways we can do that. In our last episode, you gave us some super helpful, constructive direction in terms of churches not confusing digital channels or content with digital strategy. And then you gave us some more practical, smart goals of how to just start out simple and take a first step and do it in your sweet spot where the church has some real gifts. Yeah. But we ended on something that was super fascinating. And I was kind of hoping it would be a tease to make people come back a week later for the next drop.
You don't think they'll be sick of hearing us,
but I don't know. Maybe me, but not you, because I think you're fascinating. But tell us, how did we end that conversation last time? Because you wrote this book called The Sermon on the Mount, A Practical Study Guide for Kingdom Living. And I asked you about the big idea of the Sermon on the Mount, and you went to Matthew 6:8, and you said what?
So Matthew 6:8 is seated right in the middle of the Sermon on the Mount, and Jesus is talking to his disciples, and he says, do not be like them.
And that begs what question?
I think it begs the question, then, how should we be?
Okay, that's a great place for us to pick up. So answer the question for us.
Well, if we're not to be like them,
and I'll tell you, I have a built-in bias here a little bit, Holly, is that I think oftentimes Christians define themselves more by what they're against than by what they're for, right? And there's a certain energy around differentiating yourself and saying, we're not like that. But then, okay, then what are you like?
Exactly.
Right? It's that great tension, right, biblically, of being in the world, but not of the world. And I think human beings are by nature syncretistic, which means we bring stuff in from the world, especially even to our Christianity, all the time uncritically, and we think things that are important to us are really Christian when they may be cultural or they may be personal or they may be political or they may be, we got them from other places and we've kind of put them in the soup or the stew that is our faith and stirred it all up and we think it all is the same when perhaps it's a little different. So, all right, if we're not supposed to be like them, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. Let's start there. But then if it's, we're supposed to be this way, what does that mean?
When I was writing the study, I leaned heavily on several other authors to help me exegete it well. And of course, when you do, and I think anybody who does a study on the Sermon on the Mount should have Dietrich Bonhoeffer, under their pillow.
The cost of discipleship.
Yeah, because he's really unpacking the sermon in that book. And so I think the gist is, how do we not want to be? I think when we think about the sermon, I have a cute little 3 L's that it's not. It's not legalism. Mm-hmm. It's not liberalism. And it's not lacking. And what I mean by that is, it's not legalism in that you take the Sermon on the Mount as a prescription for salvation and you say, if I do all these things, then I will be saved.
Okay.
Certainly not. We are saved by grace through faith. But the sermon gives us a guideline, and I'll come back to that when I talk about lacking. So it's not legalism. It's not salvific. Jesus is clearly speaking to his disciples in the sermon. And so I think that's important for us to understand that you already have a life of faith when you take on the text of the Sermon on the Mount. Mm. So it's not legalism. It's not salvific in and of itself, like the law. We talk a lot about Christ and the law that he does in the sermon. But so it's not legalist. It's not liberalism, in not from a political liberalism, but from a theological liberalism that, well, we don't need to worry about these ideals that he's pointing us towards because we're saved by grace. So that's the other end of the spectrum, that we don't have to worry about it. And that leads me to, it's not lacking, because I think some people look at, if you really look at the sermon, it may feel like unattainable ideals, but it is not lacking in practical usefulness and our ability to attain these things that Jesus has set before us, because by him we can. And so I think those are the ways that we potentially get it wrong. Mm. Of course, we're talking broader. Jesus was talking more broadly and do not be like them, but I'm speaking specifically of the sermon. How do we get it wrong? So then how do we get it right? I think there's a few things I would probably pull from the book. First, whether you're churched or unchurched, most people are familiar with pieces of the Sermon on the Mount. So you might have heard of the Beatitudes. You might have heard of the salt and light business. You may have heard the Golden Rule. You probably have heard there's a thing called the Lord's Prayer, whether you've ever been in a church or not. And certainly those of us who were raised in the church, we know all those things. But when you study the sermon as a whole, there's a flow to it that is, listen, I'm not against taking the Beatitudes and really sitting in those. I'm not. In fact, we do a one-day retreat study with friends that's all about the Beatitudes. So I'm here for sitting in a smaller section of scripture, but there's such a blessing in understanding it holistically. Mm. And Jesus builds. He builds. When we take these, pluck these things out of the sermon, like the Beatitudes, that's a beginning for a reason. That's the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount for a reason. And then salt and light comes after that for a reason. And then his talk about himself and the law, there's a flow there to the sermon. And so understanding it holistically is really a blessing, as we try to do that in the book. And then I think also for a lot of Christians, there's more readily identified tension with the book of James, with when it comes to faith and works, Christ and the law, how do we reconcile these things? What a lot of people are surprised, when I teach the sermon, a lot of people are surprised to hear how tightly related the sermon and James are.
Oh, yeah.
And
I mean, a lot of scholars believe that James is basically
commentary. Yeah. Whether you believe that or not, there's no question that they illuminate each other. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we do in the sermon is we take passages from James and say, this is the same idea. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of times James will develop it with more words. So just use more words or different words. And anytime someone can do that for you, it's helpful, right? Like you can say something to me and then someone else can say the same concept, explain it a different way, and I grasp it better. So that's a great way to receive the sermon rightly. And then I think when it comes to the fact that Jesus is really serious, like I said at the beginning, about our sanctification process, understanding why the law. So he says, you have heard it said, but I tell you, he's expanding the law. He's deepening the law. He's not eschewing the law in himself. I did not come to abolish, but fulfill. That's what he says. So he's helping us understand the relationship of himself to the law and how we receive it. And in a modern evangelical environment can be a little tough to assimilate because so many of us just really cling to grace as we should.
Yeah.
But this business of sanctifying, it's such a blessing. Like when we give over things like anger, lust, anxiety, all in the sermon, lying in the sermon, when we think about truth, justice, charity, prayer, these are all topics in the sermon. Why, by the way, super practical stuff we talked about. How to handle money, how to treat others, how to treat ourselves as adopted children of the King. All of those are very practical and they help us to understand how to agree with the sanctification process that God wants to grow us up in him.
So I have a thought here, Holly, and you tell me what you think of this, because I heard someone recently, pretty well known, and I think honestly one of the better synthetic thinkers out there today, who is not Reformed in their background, but appreciates Reformed theology and I think understands it and articulates it as well as most people who actually are Reformed. Mm-hmm. So it's not like this person is dismissing it. I think they really get it. They understand it and are able to appreciate it. But he made this comment in a podcast that I was listening to that people from a Reformed background tend to breeze past the Sermon on the Mount. Mm-hmm. And it was because the other traditions, like the one that he was a part of, which focus more on sanctification, gravitate toward the Sermon on the Mount for the very reasons that you just mentioned. I always think that all of us as Christians, particularly evangelical Christians in the Western tradition, we tend to cherry pick the scripture passages that reinforce our predispositions and our worldview and so forth. And we have certain favorites that we run to, but like we read the Sermon on the Mount, maybe devotionally, but we haven't really sat down in that space and said, this is Jesus's teaching on what it means to follow him and live in the kingdom he brought on earth. And why is it that you think as Reformed Christians, we don't spend more time in the Sermon on the Mount? Do you have any thoughts on that? Because I think that accusation is basically fair.
I do, and I think it's a human thing. I think that we want life is hard, and we want church to be comfy, and it's not really designed to be comfortable.
Right.
It's designed to be growing, and growth a lot of times hurts.
Right. And that's part of the sanctification process, right?
So one of the things we do in the one day retreat, I didn't do it in the book, but that's the great thing about being able to do a retreat. You can do things you didn't have time or pages to do in the book. One thing we do with the Beatitudes retreat is we talk about how literally the Beatitudes are all Christians all the time, that all Christians all the time are the blessed. Well, we look at that like, oh, blessed are the, and it seems out there. And so I think there's an element of if I'm not comfortable or if it doesn't feel like it resounds with me right now, am I going to do the work of carving myself out to make space for it deep inside? And that's hard work, right? Jesus says, I'm the vine, you're the branches. There's pruning. Pruning hurts. That's a cutting. I don't think mostly humans are excited to do that, you know?
Yeah, I read the Beatitudes and I have to deal with my anger issues. Right. And that's painful. Yeah.
Or what does it mean to be poor in spirit? What does that really mean? How can I be poor in spirit right now? We talked about that. I think it was the last episode. Like, what is the practical use of meek? What does that mean? How can I be meek every day, all the time? And so it's not a personality trait. It's a character of all Christians.
Right.
A characteristic.
Right.
So I think that it's hard work and hard. I mean, I'm the first one to say like hard work. No, I don't want to do it. I would rather watch Netflix and eat popcorn, but the hard work has a blessing. There's a blessing there. And the blessing is the relationship with God as he, like every good father loves us no matter what, but also wants to see us reach our full potential. And God is the same. He loves us. But he wants us to reach our full potential, who he designed us to be. And that means growth.
Well, and that means the full embodiment of the kingdom in our lives, right? Mm-hmm. There's this old phrase that says the king and the kingdom are one. And if you're following the king, then the principles of the way he lives in this world, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. He rolls that out for us. So that's part of discipleship. And you're so big on that in terms of, you know, kind of bridging the not only digital world, but you're doing retreats and you're pointing people intentionally, purposefully. You said in an earlier episode, always point them to Christ and then point them to the local church. Mm-hmm. And that's what all of this is doing. But you've got a number of other resources that you guys have developed to help people do those very things. So the Sermon on the Mount, the practical study of the kingdom living is one, but you're also a big student of apologetics as a part of discipleship. So could we pivot there and talk? Because your life, in a sense, is an apologetic, right? I mean, if you're living the Sermon on the Mount, you're going to create like conversations with people, and people are going to notice that the way you're living and the way you're thinking and the way you're behaving, the way you're just living this life is just very, very different. And that's going to open up conversations. Mm-hmm. And you feel very strongly that people should be able to give a reasonable defense for their faith.
I do. And I get pretty energized about that. So excuse me if I get a little louder about this part, because I get very excited about apologetics. I get a little frustrated with people who just blow it off, because I think having an apologetic, just having a couple tools in the toolbox from an apologetic standpoint.
What would some of those tools be? Could you unpack that a little bit?
Yes. One of the tools would be the Kalam cosmological argument.
Oh my goodness. You're going to have to go there for the layperson to unpack that a little bit.
I did that to be funny. Yeah, it is true. You should have an understanding of it, although you should never say to someone you're evangelizing, let me explain the Kalam cosmological argument.
Well, can you explain the
Kalam? I can, and I will. But that's the point, is that we should have a few nuggets that we can be conversational on so that we can engage a non-believer. And so this, when we talk about apologetics, we got to talk about like the bubble. Are you living in a bubble? Do you have conversations only with other Christians? Do you only have conversations with people who agree with you? If so, it's time to hit your knees and ask God to forgive you of that, because he calls us to be in the world, be showing the world, and be talking to the world, and be prepared with an answer.
And maybe while you're on your knees, ask God to bring somebody across your path, or you across somebody's path, who doesn't think like a Christian. Yeah. That's going to sharpen you in terms of being able to be a good ambassador and represent the kingdom to them.
I had, as I was developing my apologetics chops, which are still largely undeveloped, but I had a friend, his name was Larry, and I found him, I'm not going to tell the whole story, but I found him online because he has a well-developed atheist website and podcast. And what I wanted was to engage with someone who was as deeply committed to his atheism as I am to my faith, because otherwise I felt like maybe I wasn't really getting all the deep things that atheists are believing. And so I just emailed him. I found a blog he wrote called 22 Questions Christians Are Afraid You'll Ask. And I remember reading them on an airplane. I don't know where I was coming to or going from, but I was like, am I afraid of these questions? And in my mind, I started to formulate some answers, and I really had to think about it. And so I reached out to him, because I'm just like that. I was like, hey. And he was like, I would love to talk to you. And so we started meeting over Zoom regularly. And honestly, I mean, if we're both being honest, we were sharpening our chops for our home base.
Okay.
But he was challenging me in ways that I had to be intentional about putting myself out there to be challenged, put my faith out there to be challenged. And I come from a family of scientists. So my uncle was literally a rocket scientist. He worked for NASA. I come from a family of atheists. We talked about my brother, but beyond my immediate family, it's highly atheistic. I'm very science-based and very naturalistic is the apologetics world nomenclature that we would use. And so I didn't like not, you know, sitting around campfires and not having answers to their questions, because I'm prideful and I wanted to be right. And I didn't like that they felt like they were right. And so that was what started me on my apologetics journey. And that's 25 years ago.
Okay. So let's go back to this cosmological argument, because you dropped that bomb and you walked away from it. So what is that?
Well, let me say that I think there are probably 2 to 4 apologetics nuggets that we should be conversational. And that's what the book is about.
Okay.
So the book is,
we'll see if you nail mine, because I have one. I'm not telling you what it is.
You have an argument?
Of course I do.
Okay. Well, these are broad brushstrokes.
Okay.
And one of the things I'll introduce before I say the Kalam is we hit hard, and you're noticing a theme that I think that Christians have to be relational. We have to be winsome. We have to be compassionate. We have to be disarming. And so all throughout the book.
Yeah, this isn't about being argumentative.
That's right. That's right. And I say,
what's
do you want to be?
By the way?
It's called Searching for God. And I was blessed to be able to do this project with Lee Strobel and J. Warner Wallace and Nabil Qureshi. And Paul Copan wrote the introduction. So great apologists who would explain this much better than I would, among others. There were about 10. And sort of my job was to be a little bit pastoral. And these arguments are strong, and they can be hurtful if they're used wrongly. Mm. We don't want to shame people or make them feel stupid or be
condescending.
Yeah, it's not confrontational. Judgment. Yeah. Right. So all throughout the book, we talk about what the phrase I use is compassionate conversations. Mm. A phrase I use not in the book, but as I talk about apologetics, is a tactic that I call disarm and deconstruct. So when you're talking to somebody about their beliefs, they hold their beliefs that the same way you do, like that's their beliefs.
Right.
So to treat those beliefs disrespectfully is never going to get you to the goal of having them really entertain your beliefs. So you first have to disarm, like they have to put the gun down and we have to stop pointing guns at each other, disarm by validating and empathizing.
And listening.
Yes.
Asking good questions.
Exactly. That's my big thing is asking better. I say, just ask a better question. When someone says this about your faith, ask a better question. But we could talk long and about that. We won't. No, episode 4. So Kalam is one of them. Kalam cosmological argument is basically this. William Lane Craig does a great job. There's 3 points. When it comes to Kalam, I abbreviate Kalam cosmological argument, there's a flow to apologetics. So first you have to establish a creator. I don't think you can start with Jesus. I'd love to start with Jesus, but you got to get there. You got to make your way to Jesus.
Right.
Some people will give you an opening, but I think from a building block standpoint, especially with an atheist, so Kalam is really to help with atheists and naturalists, people who believe if I can't touch, feel, measure it, it doesn't exist. So the Kalam cosmological argument is very simple. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore the universe has a cause. And that's really simple, but very hard to argue with, and you can develop it in that I always start with, so as an atheist, then you believe in the Big Bang. And that's a trap, and I admit it. Okay? But it's just finding common ground.
Uh-huh.
And pretty much every atheist will say, yes, I believe in the Big Bang because that's a scientifically prevalent, you know, theory to the universe right now. So everything that began to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist. Therefore, the universe had a cause. Then what was the cause? And this is where we have the ability to have found common ground and then unpack it.
And I think one of the ways I've unpacked that when I've had that conversation, Holly, is I say at that point, you're going to place your faith in something.
Mm-hmm. Everyone right? does.
Because whichever way you go in that, if you mm-hmm. go toward a creator, personal God, or you go towards just some series of random things that have come together to make the Big Bang happen, you're still placing your faith in something that we can't know completely. Right? We know because we have a relationship with the creator experientially, but it still takes faith to do that. So at some point when you get to that causality, you're saying you're putting your faith in something. What are you putting your faith in?
Right. So that's, I think, a really good tool to have in your toolbox. So okay. That's what we call Kalam for short, or the cosmological argument. And you can develop it by saying, okay, if things are just going to pop into existence, why don't we see that all the time? You can really develop it. And we do develop in the book. And the book has the study guide, and then it has a video series where those apologists and more.
So that might be a good thing for a small group to do.
It's a great thing for us, but it's also great for an individual. Like it's easy to receive. And that was really my job, was to make these really brainy dudes and one woman, accessible to the everyman through the study guide. So that's one tool I think we have to have in our toolbox culturally, because okay. we experience a lot of atheism, naturalism.
I don't want to give them all away, but can you give me one more tool before we wrap it up?
Yeah. Do you want relativism or pluralism?
Ooh, let's go with pluralism.
Okay. So pluralism is the idea that, so to clarify, pluralism on its own is a good thing. Like
sure.
the melting pot of like many things, many cultures, like we don't say that that's bad.
So the good parts about that, you can again find common ground.
Exactly.
On, right.
But religious pluralism is the idea that we're all worshiping the same God.
Why can't we all just get along?
Yeah. So, or in the end, aren't we all the same? Aren't all faiths basically the same? And I think it's really easy. That's a great springboard because if you just go one layer deeper, you really can present the fact that that's impossible because they have competing truth claims. And what do I mean? So I'm using apologetic words. What are competing truth claims? That means that Jesus, God is either one or he is three, but he can't be both. God either had a son or he didn't, but it can't be both. So if there are competing truth claims to each of these different faiths, which we'd love to be able to say, everybody's really believing in the same God, Allah and God, the father of the Christian Bible are the same God. We can't say that. I often say that's actually insulting to the people who believe these things because they would be the first to tell you that true believers would tell you our truth claims, the foundation of our faith do not agree with other major world faiths. And so can't be all, has to be one or the other or neither, but it can't be all.
Okay. So help people step towards the fact where they realize that different worldviews and world religions have competing truth claims.
More than what I just, like the Muslim example.
Yeah.
Either there is a God, one God, or there are multiple gods, right? So Hinduism would espouse multiple deities. So that's another competing truth claim.
Right.
Or there is no God. So Buddhists, they're just foundationally different. And there's a uniqueness, and we end the book on the uniqueness of Christianity, which is ours is the only path by which you don't have to wonder, was I good enough?
Right.
And that's important.
That's huge. Because ultimately, every other world religion, worldview, philosophy comes down to works at some point.
Yeah.
You got to be smarter. You got to work harder. You got to think differently. You've got to behave differently. You've got to, I mean, it's all more.
Yeah.
And ultimately it's crushing under the weight of it because we can never do those things.
So, and we're not living in peace at all.
Yeah.
And we also deal with relativism in the book, which is my truth, your truth. And here's the bottom line. I think it's so important. I'm so passionate about just do something with apologetics in your discipleship plan for your church or for yourself, because working in apologetics deepens our faith as we ask these questions and see them satisfactorily answered. And it gives us the ability to evangelize in all spaces.
So I have two final questions, okay? And we need to be kind of be concise on this. So here we go. The one is, for the person who feels intimidated by apologetics, but still feels compelled to do evangelism.
Mm-hmm.
How do apologetics and evangelism relate? Because a person could just use the three circles, and if a person is experiencing brokenness in their lives, there's an access point there to be able to share the gospel with them. But in a lot of conversations, that opening evangelistic conversation just leads to more conversations mm-hmm. where people have deeper questions.
Mm-hmm.
So is that where apologetics comes in as kind of it can be either opening the door to an evangelistic conversation, or it can be kind of coming back and giving more substantive answers that started with an evangelistic conversation.
I think that, like we've been talking about the whole time, evangelism has to be relational.
Right.
I love the great apologists who stand on a stage and have great debates, but I always say evangelism and apologetics, conversions don't happen at the end of a wagging finger. They happen on a couch or over a cup of coffee. And so I think that a lot of times as Christians, we leave conversations with non-believers saying, I wish I had said, or I wish I knew the answers. And here's the thing. You're never going to have all the answers. Be transparent about that.
Right.
But journeying together with a seeker to say, let's talk again next week and let me get some ideas together on this question. Then you go and you deepen your own apologetics toolbox. And so I think that's how they work together. So you encourage and respect questions and disagreement. And then you own that you don't have all the answers and you're not the smartest person in the room, and you be humble, like Christ called us to be humble and winsome. And you say, I don't know, that's a great question. Or you might be able to say when you're down the road, I had that question too, and here's what I researched and found out. And so I think that's how it intersects.
Okay, let me land on this place, and I'm sorry to do this to you because I think you could talk on this one for another half an hour. But land on this one. you have a special concern that in the area of apologetics that women seem to eschew that versus it kind of embrace that. Mm-hmm. Could you speak to that briefly?
You might not like my answer, but I'm going to give it to you.
Okay.
The problem is that there only are men being platformed in apologetics.
Okay.
And we're making some changes to that. There are plenty of brilliant women who feel as passionate as I do about apologetics, and we just need to platform them, because if I see consciously or subconsciously it's only men, then I'm just going to feel like I don't have a seat at that table. I mean, I felt like that when it was time to write this book. I was like, I don't belong in that group, not because it was men, but because I felt like they were so much more wise than I was. But if we look at a group of people who have a bank of knowledge, and we feel like for whatever reason we're on the outside looking in, then it makes us maybe go in another direction and pursue something else.
But it also really limits the scope of who we can reach with those things, because there's a lot of people out there that won't connect with men as they take those arguments.
Yeah.
And so I appreciate the fact that you've entered that space. So yeah, let me see the book again.
Here it is.
Okay. So two books to encourage folks to. Searching for God, Is There Any Reason to Believe in God Today? Where Holly has worked with a whole group of people putting together these 6-session study guides. And the Sermon on the Mount, we talked about earlier, Practical Study for Kingdom Living. Those can both be found at your website, I'm assured. how do people find Study with Friends, and how do they get a hold of you, Holly?
Studywithfriends.org.
Really simple. All yeah. One word.
Yep.
No just dots in there. No
study with friends.
Study with friends.
And listen, anybody who's listening to this, I love the EPC. I'm a huge fan. And so anybody who's listening, I mean, just if you have anything that you'd like, if you want me to come talk to people at your church, if you want me to do a Zoom session with people, like info@studywithfriends.org, just email us.
Great. Presbytery resourcing, congregational resourcing, evangelism, discipleship, digital, apologetics. She does it all, ladies and gentlemen. Ruling elder and soon to be moderator of the Presbytery of the East, Holly Lazaro. Thank you, Holly. These 3 sessions could have gone to 10 sessions, but we have to stop somewhere.
That was fun.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been a delight. Well, my friends, I hope you've enjoyed these, and I hope you'll take this kind of this set of 3, and you'll listen to them, you'll package them, you'll give them to people in your church or small group that could kind of access some of these resources. Go to Holly's website at studywithfriends.org, see the resources there. I love the fact that she's super intentional about not only, first of all, pointing us to Jesus, but also pointing to the local church. And that is right where the heart of the EPC is. And for that, we are deeply, deeply grateful. And so we end, as we always do, my friends, with this good word from God. Word as a reminder that this covers everything we've been talking about and then some. The Son is the image of the invisible God. You know that. He is the firstborn over all creation. You know that. For in him all things were created. Things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, our discipleship, our ability to give an answer to those who speak and question of our faith and to share that good news with others. All of these things have been created through him and for him, because he is before all things, my friends. That's the causality piece, big time. And in him, of course, all things hold together. That includes you and me, my friends, in each one of these conversations and the precious church that is the bride of Jesus Christ, because Jesus is the head of the body, the church. And that especially includes the EPC, to which we invite you on any given Sunday to come and check out an EPC church somewhere near you, that you could receive the life-saving message of Jesus Christ and grow as one of his followers. Well, my friends, until we join again in another such conversation, I bid grace and peace to you.
Thank you again for joining us. On behalf of the entire team, please join us for our next episode. For more information about the EPC, including a directory of local churches, online resources, and much more, visit our website at www.epc.org. I'm Rachel Joseph. I pray you have an overwhelming sense of God's presence in all things today.